Transit was headed for passage, but 10 Republicans voted for the bill rather quickly, and the eventual total number of defections gave the bill more than just a veneer of bipartisanship, especially when combined with a Senate vote. The National Review summed it up accordingly. Disgraceful House Republicans rescued Joe Biden's failing agenda. 13 Republicans swooped in to rescue Nancy Pelosi, provide Joe Biden with the biggest victory of his presidency, and put the rest of his reckless agenda on a glide path to passage in the House. This is a substantively bad decision that is political malpractice. It represents a betrayal. Politically, it's unclear what Republicans are thinking. President Biden entered this week reeling from a devastating rebuke of his presidency by voters in areas of the country thought to be reliably Democratic. He headed into the 2022 election year a wounded animal, and Republicans stood to make major gains. Now they tossed him a life raft and allowed him to put bipartisan gloss on his radical agenda. Every Republican who voted for this monstrosity, who is not already retiring, should be primaried and defeated by candidates who will actually resist the left-wing agenda. Those who are retiring should be shamed for the rest of their lives. It also is not too soon to be asking whether Representative Kevin McCarthy should be ousted from leadership for his inability to keep his caucus together on such a crucial vote. And that last one is a key point here. The bill included lots of popular projects and in another era probably wouldn't have gotten significantly more GOP votes. But we live in this era in which delivering a political win for the other side, however popular the bill and however much your constituents might want it, is seen as apostasy. The demand in the GOP for such devotion to the party line and its election prospects is even greater than on the other side. Republicans are still likely to win the House in 2022 midterm elections, despite the doom and gloom on the GOP side, and even as it's likely the bill's passage will help Democrats electorally. That puts Kevin McCarthy in line to be House Speaker. But we've written before about the undersold potential debate over whether he would even be elevated to a post he's already failed to grab hold of once. Kevin McCarthy's leadership has been quite often uneven, and the demands in the GOP are sky-high for such posts. Scalise, too, would seem to be in line for some criticism given his status as the party's whip. The anger for now seems more focused on those 13 Republicans. It's possible Democrats would have been able to pass the bill without them. The GOP crossover votes allowed the progressives who had been holding out to vote no and stick to their principled stance. But the end result is that, objectively, this bill passed thanks to GOP votes. Whether Kevin McCarthy could have prevented the bill's passage is a valid question. He doesn't control the majority after all, but his party and its base aren't really big on that kind of nuance. And it's unlikely the anger over what transpired on Friday will subside quickly. The Republicans who voted for the infrastructure bill, the defectors were Don Bacon of Nebraska, Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, Andrew Garbarino of New York, Anthony Gonzalez of Ohio, John Katko of New York, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, Nicole Maniotakis of New York, David McKinley of West Virginia, Tom Reed of New York, Chris Smith of New Jersey, Fred Upton of Michigan, Jeff Van Drew of New Jersey, and Don Young of Alaska.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly I would say, Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Talk about the unlawful gains according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Let's take a listen to a short biography and we'll be back.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtadha Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about unlawful gains according to Ayatollah Khamenei, and let me ask you this question. If the cargo contains the meat of not ritually slaughtered animals, all right,
yes,
according to the Sharia and Islamic laws, is it permissible to transport it? And if there is any difference, is there any difference whether the receiver considers this halal or not?
I think I did mention from the I did say in one of the previous answers that it's not permissible to engage in trading such things, and of course when it comes to transporting non-halal meat, of course Ayatollah declare fatwa.
Mm-hmm.
There's no precaution, there's no ihtiyat according to him. He says it's not permissible to transport non-halal meat if it is used for human consumption. That's the main point, human consumption. And it does not make any difference whether the potential buyer sees it fit for consumption or otherwise, you know. It does not make any difference, irrespective of whether the client or the consumer, let's say, sees it, or the buyer actually,
mm-hmm.
sees it as fit for consumption or unfit. In either case, it is not permissible to transport non-halal meat. And you know, Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwa is very absolute, very much categorical in its nature. He does not specify what kind of halal haram meat it is. You know, it does not make any difference whether the meat is pork or whether it is meat of haram any other animals. You know, he says it's not permissible to carry it for consumption.
Mm-hmm.
But if the buyer uses it for any other halal purposes, of course, there's no problem.
I see. Okay. Sheikh Javed, is it permissible, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, to sell blood to whoever can make use of it?
Well, in modern time, you know, blood is used for a lot of purposes,
yes.
Rational and very for good purposes, of course. In old times, you know, there was no use for blood because the blood could not be transfused into another person's body. But now it has become quite possible, and of course, it's very much possible to save a person's life through transfusion, and it becomes even sometimes necessary to donate their blood in order to save God or to protect someone's life.
Mm-hmm.
According to Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, there's no objection to sell blood for a rational purpose, and according to for a rational purpose and also a sharia purpose, you know. For example, when it comes to protecting someone's life, when someone is in dire need of blood, then there's no objection, of course, to even sell it to sell your blood to someone. Even, you know, generally speaking, selling things which are essentially najis, impure, is forbidden. But when it comes to blood, blood is also essentially
impure.
But Ayatollah Khamenei and all other religious authorities are of the view that it is permissible to sell your blood to someone who needs it.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter whether they are Muslim or non-Muslim.
Yeah, of course, it does not.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, and our guest speaker is still Sheikh Javed, and we are still talking about the subject of unlawful gains according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javed, I know that you reiterated in the previous episodes and even this one that a Muslim is not allowed to sell haram food such as pork, right? Or meat of not ritually slaughtered animals, or even intoxicants to non-Muslims in non-Muslim countries. So what about these scenarios? Let me ask you these cases one by one, okay?
Sure.
The person dealing in these items is not the owner himself or herself. So he or she does not make any profit, but the work is just selling these food items alongside other halal ones.
Well, obviously, according to the answer given in one of the previous episodes, if not in this episode, of course, Ayatollah Khamenei is of the view that it's not permissible to sell these haram stuff, even if you are not the owner yourself, and if you even if you do not make any profit from the sale of these haram stuff. Of course, making any kind of gains through the sale of pork, meat, which is not slaughtered according to Islamic laws, or let's say alcoholic beverages, is not permissible. And regardless of whether the recipient or the person or the consumer is a Muslim or a non-Muslim.
Mm-hmm. I see. How about this scenario, Sheikh Shawit? You know, sometimes the businesses are run or owned by several people, so they have joint shares in the business or businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So the person concerned jointly owns the business with a non-Muslim partner.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Yeah.
So there's one Muslim partner, the other one non-Muslim.
Yeah.
All right? And they can make sure that which share or which segment of the money or the profit would go to each one of the two partners.
Yeah.
So the halal money goes to the Muslim and the non-halal money goes to the non-Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
So what about this case? If they can, you know, share the profit this way, separately?
Well, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, even this this kind of dealing
mm-hmm.
or transaction is not permissible because the whole setup is managed and run
mm-hmm.
by two individuals. Even though, for example, as you said, the halal franchise is separated from the haram one,
mm-hmm.
or maybe the halal segment is different and separated or segregated from the haram one, and the two individuals have their own separate income, of course. Ayatollah Khamenei strictly forbids even this kind of joint partnership. But let me just make a point here when it comes to Ayatollah Sistani's opinion. Of course, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that there's no objection to having such a separate franchise. For example, if someone else is there in the West, of course, people are sometimes forced to work in a hotel or work at a gas station. Of course, the gas station usually sells alcohol and other halal and haram
at
stuff.
Convenience stores.
Ayatollah Sistani, for example, says that it's not permissible. It is permissible to let someone else sell alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sell halal stuff, but
yes.
someone else does the they sells the haram stuff. There's no problem, and because you as a simple worker, you can your income is halal in this way. But Ayatollah Khamenei says no, it's not permissible to have a joint partner to run a hotel or a restaurant or a cafe with someone else in a joint partnership. And of course, he strictly forbids this.
Thank you very much, Sheikh
Javid.
That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو الوحيد القدير. onto our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian senior officials and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Out of the nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the MKO. Yet, the West, which claims to be against terrorism, supports this terrorist group officially. Despite all the crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the US removed the widely detested terrorist group from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012, respectively. West even misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor by putting a blind eye to how the MKO spilled the blood of innocent people. On November 4th, the ringleader of MKO, Maryam Rajavi, delivered an online address to an Italian Senate panel on the situation of human rights in Iran. 2 days later, the Secretary of Human Rights Headquarters of the Iranian Judiciary, Kazem Gharibabadi, condemned the session. He slammed Western countries for adopting a selective approach to human rights by allowing the anti-Iran Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization to hold, quote, ridiculous meetings on the issue in the host countries. He also called on the Italian government to end their dual and destructive policies towards terrorism and human rights. Iran has long complained that the West's backing for terrorist organizations like MKO violates the UN Charter and international principles. The West accuses Iran of human rights violations, yet their double standard policies towards terrorism speak for themselves. Also, in July at a sideline meeting at the 47th session of the United Nations Human Rights Council, diplomats, scholars, and representatives from NGOs criticized Western countries for their hypocrisy on human rights and using it as a geopolitical tool to attack countries that do not serve their interests.
But, you know, groups like MKO have been legitimized as not a terrorist group any longer, because it serves a purpose. It's giving Western nations a sort of what they want, creating acts of terrorism in Iran, and indeed assassination of scientists.
The US itself has been long accused of violating human rights. Their violations have been blatant when it comes to racial discrimination, especially against the African American community. The case of George Floyd, an African-American man who was murdered by a police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, is one example of many. Hezbollah in Lebanon, popular mobilization forces in Iraq, and Ansarullah movement in Yemen are against the interests and policies of the West. Therefore, the they are designated as terrorist organizations by Western countries. That's why these extremes have fought hard and are the true defenders of the rights of their countries and regional nations. Meanwhile, MKO terrorists enjoy the freedom of activity in the US and Europe, and even hold regular meetings in which European and American officials make speeches. West's support for such a terrorist cult only exposes their double standards when it comes to terrorist organizations. And let's not forget the Western countries, namely the US, support for one of the biggest violators of human rights, the Israeli regime, an illegitimate regime that has a long list of human rights violations, including the occupation of Palestinian land, illegal settlement activities, inhumane blockade on Palestinians, administrative detentions, and many others.
The whole, there needs to be unity on combating those who commit acts of terrorism internationally, rather than this sort of use of the terrorist group as allies, and then giving them international support and international legitimacy. MKO is the perfect example of this, but unfortunately is not the only one.
The US, Britain, and France are among violators of human rights. They use sanctions to pressure other governments to give in to their demands, while that directly affects the civilian population and causes hardship for them. These countries have not only supported dictatorial regimes like Saudi Arabia, whom they have sold weapons to in a war in Yemen, they have also supported the Israeli regime that violates Palestinian rights. Meanwhile, the West's anti-Iran obsession and shameful support for terrorism smacks of double standards. The Saudi-led coalition seized three fuel tankers heading for war-torn Yemen nearly 3 months ago. On Saturday, Yemen's petroleum company put out a statement slamming the Saudi-led coalition's illegal confiscation of three oil ships carrying a collective amount of over 80,000 tons of diesel and preventing them from reaching the port of Hodeidah. Saudi Arabia still prevents vessels from docking in Hodeidah port, despite them having received UN permits for sailing in international waters. Earlier this year, Yemen's Minister of Oil and Minerals, Ahmed Abdullah Dares, warned that the Saudi seizure of ships carrying petroleum products could lead to the suspension of the service sectors and cause a humanitarian catastrophe. The fuel blockade contributes to a much broader Saudi-led blockade campaign against Yemenis. The coalition's military forces have stopped planes from landing and ships from docking in Yemen. Many critics had prophesied that the blockade would keep much-needed food, fuel, medicine, and humanitarian aid from reaching desperate Yemenis, including millions of children. In fact, the World Food Program has estimated that around 400,000 Yemeni children under 5 are likely to die of starvation in 2021. That is nearly one child every 80 seconds. Also, over 16 million Yemenis are on the brink of acute starvation. That's almost half of the country's population. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies, backed by the US, launched a war on Yemen. Their goal was to reinstate the friendly government of Abd Rabu Mansur Hadi and to eliminate the Ansarullah movement. However, so far they failed, and the war has only left tens of thousands of people dead and millions more displaced.
There's been a history of the United Nations failing in the region, and as far away as 2016, the UK blocked a call for the establishment of an independent international inquiry. So we can see the United Nations is really controlled by members who have really no interest in the human rights of the people of Yemen.
The UN says more than 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, describing the country as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The ongoing fuel oil blockade against Yemen has led to food and medicine shortages. These items cannot be transported without fuel. Also, many hospitals experience power outages as they do not have enough power to keep the lights on amid the coronavirus pandemic. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden refuses to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade on Yemen and stopping its deadly airstrikes. On the other hand, it tries to change the narrative in favor of the kingdom. For instance, Washington refuses to blame Riyadh for the current fuel shortage in Yemen. The U.S. says the Saudi coalition only blocks ships and planes that the Hadi government doesn't grant permission to. Therefore, it's the Hadi government that's imposing the blockade. But Washington's shameless support for Saudi Arabia doesn't end here. The Pentagon said the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles was approved by the State Department in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The missile sale follows the U.S. approval of a $500 million helicopter maintenance deal for the kingdom in September. The sale flatly contradicts Biden's sayings during the first major foreign policy speech of his presidency that the U.S. is ending its support for the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen.
Well, some people believe that America's economy is built around merchandising debt in general. The sale of $650 million recently, this week, to Saudi Arabia by the U.S. is really, from their position, the support of the U.S. foreign policy to the national security interests of the United States.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement has reacted to the new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia, saying it proves Washington's continued support for Riyadh's warmongering and that the Biden administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. The arms supplies to Saudi Arabia have already sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. But it seems the green Saudi dollars are worth a lot more to the U.S. than the lives of innocent Yemeni civilians and children.
Tensions are simmering in Ethiopia, where a year-long war between government forces and fighters of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, is feared to intensify. The TPLF is the party ruling in the northern Tigray region. It used to hold power in Ethiopia until the parliamentary elections in 2018, when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed took over with the support of country's largest ethnic groups, the Oromo and Amhara. On Friday, however, eight rebel groups, including the Oromo Liberation Front, agreed in Washington to join forces with the TPLF to form a coalition against the government, striking up an alliance between the historic foes.
The main reason why this alliance is significant is it's another example of them using this level of psychological warfare. This particular announcement, and what I would like to say grandiose event in D.C., coupled with the media's focus of the armies marching to the Capitol in the last few days, is just another way to create this level of manufactured consent from the people so they can feel as though, wow, well, the Ethiopian government is already lost, so I must try to put my hope into TPLF or this alliance in some case.
Ethiopia declared a nationwide state of emergency on the 2nd of November amid concerns that the forces, which are now within a day's drive from the capital Addis Ababa, may be considering attacking the city. The United Nations Security Council called for a halt to the fighting in Ethiopia on Friday, urging talks to end intensifying hostilities.
They further call to put an end to hostilities and to negotiate a lasting ceasefire and for the creation of conditions for the start of an inclusive Ethiopian national dialogue to resolve the crisis and create the foundation for peace and stability throughout the country.
The council members also expressed deep concern about the growing violence in northern Ethiopia. They urged the warring sides to refrain from inflammatory hate speech and incitement to violence. The council members also called for unhindered access for humanitarian aid and and the reestablishment of public services, among others. The announcement of the alliance between 9 Ethiopian rebel groups in Washington coincided with the U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman's meeting with the Ethiopian Prime Minister amid calls for an immediate ceasefire and talks to end the war.
It's really interesting to note that TPLF has had a long-standing relationship to the U.S. and other European powers. And the evidence here is, look at the ruling party within TPLF or the different officials and generals, and look at their assets and where they're stored.
The United Nations published a report this week that suggests both sides of the conflict have committed atrocities that may amount to war crimes. The conflict in the Tigray region erupted on November 4th last year, when Ethiopia launched an offensive against the TPLF troops who allegedly attacked a federal army camp. The government declared victory at the end of November, but clashes have continued in the region. Soon after the start of the conflict, Eritrea, TPLF's longtime enemy, joined Ethiopia in attacking the rebels. The UN report suggests that Eritrean troops have also killed hundreds of civilians in Tigray in a matter of days. Due to a communications blackout and restricted access to the region for journalists, little is known about the extent of humanitarian crisis in the region. The fate of millions of Ethiopians is now hanging in the balance, with no end in sight for the persecution in the absence of any meaningful international action.
Taiwan is an island in East Asia which has been self-ruled since 1950. The People's Republic of China regards it as a breakaway region that must one day be reunited with the mainland. Beijing has never ruled out the use of force to bring the island under its control. The situation has become very tense since President Tsai Ing-wen came into office in 2016. She has said Taiwan is independent and not part of China. The United States and some of its European allies have been expanding their relations with Taiwan despite Chinese opposition. The Chinese government has been angered by the growing trade and military ties between the West and Taiwan. In response to the West's growing support for the island, China has been flexing its military muscles in the region. Tensions escalated this week between the U.S. and China over Taiwan after America's top general signaled that America stands ready to intervene if a conflict erupts in the region. U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley said the U.S. military absolutely could defend Taiwan from a potential Chinese attack if asked to do so. How far is the United States really willing to go over Taiwan? Will it be ready to confront another nuclear-armed superpower, given all the risks and possible costs involved, where success is not guaranteed at all?
This sounds very much like typical political positioning before some sort of a negotiation. The United States certainly does not have any positive interest in making a war over Taiwan, except, of course, to sell weapons and to spend taxpayers' money.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said on Thursday that, quote, the negative and erroneous words and deeds of the U.S. related to the Taiwan question have encouraged the blatancy of the Taiwan secessionists. He also blamed Washington for the increasing tension across the Taiwan Strait. Beijing has reiterated that the issue of Taiwan is a red line that must not be crossed, but the West seems to be determined to challenge China. This week, the European Parliament's first official delegation to the island said Taiwan is not alone and called for measures to bolster EU-Taiwan ties. Beijing condemned the trip, urging the European side to correct its mistakes and not send any wrong signals to Taiwan, warning that it will harm China-EU relations. Where does Europe really stand on this issue?
The Europeans are typically following Germany and making supportive sounds in the support of U.S. foreign policy, but are not prepared to physically become engaged, especially after the debacle in Afghanistan. So I would suggest that we can call the European comments on this topic chatter on the line. In other words, a background noise that's not critical to the situation.
The EU seems to be following policies close to those of the US. The West knows all too well that China is highly unlikely to back down on the issue of Taiwan. Why is it then being so provocative? Is it trying to create a conflict in the region close to China's borders? The US has been selling many billions of dollars worth of weapons to the self-ruled island. And US President Joe Biden has made no secret of his priority to contain China's influence. This leaves little doubt that Taiwan will remain a very serious bone of contention between the two sides for years to come.
Norway's capital is once again the scene of a mesmerizing annual life festival. This year's Fjord Oslo Life Festival started on Friday and will run until Sunday. Numerous artists have had the opportunity to showcase their dazzling designs by lighting up important buildings in the Norwegian capital. This year's biggest installation is called The Abyss, which was inspired by animals living in the deep ocean. Modern technology has changed our lives in countless ways, with robots now preparing to lend a hand in operation rooms. Surgical robots are on display at the 4th China International Import Expo. One of the machines, dubbed Mesa X, gives assistance in spinal surgery. Employing the robot can lessen bleeding by 50% compared to open surgeries. Another one assists doctors to perform interventional surgery.
Vessels can be controlled even less than 1 millimeter. This is not cannot be achieved by the human hands. With the great, I think, market impact from this showcase, we successfully performed a first case PCI in Hainan Boao on March 13th.
The producers say surgical robots will soon operate in more hospitals around China. Therefore, training centers have been established to help surgeons learn how to operate the new generation of surgical robots.
A tigress belonging to the endangered Bengal species has given birth to four cubs at the Mexican Zoo, bringing joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts. The four were born in the San Jorge Park in the city of Ciudad Juarez on October 10th. Nearly a month on, they are in good health. That is good news, because usually when multiple cubs are born, not all of them survive. Zoo officials have not yet determined the sex of the newborn cubs. That is because their mother lets out a roar when the vets are nearby. Bengal tigers are endangered for two reasons: poaching and the destruction of their natural habitat. Here's what you can call killing two birds with one stone. Classic car lovers have gone on an exciting rally to see an erupting volcano. The event, organized by Beshbuk Rallies, happened on a Saturday. Motorists taking part in the vintage rally had the unique opportunity to witness a volcano erupting ash and smoke. Most of the participants tried to get as close as they could to the volcano, but there were also those who chose to take other vehicles because they were afraid that their precious antique cars would be damaged.
Workers digging gas pipes in the Peruvian capital Lima have discovered a cemetery dating back to millennia.
Archaeologists have recovered six bodies, including those of children. All of them were buried in a seated position. The site also yielded about 40 burial vessels. The findings are thought to belong to the culture known as White on Red, which settled on the central coast of Peru centuries ago during the pre-Hispanic era.
Often, it does not take much to bring about positive social change. In Johannesburg, a group of painters are creating artworks on the trolleys of street recyclers. Reason? To encourage bystanders to look up and notice the work recyclers, locally known as reclaimers, do in the community.
I like my work to have meaning, so when I get to paint and become a part of a project like this, it's great for me, you know, because it's not every day we get to like do stuff like this, so yeah.
Up until now, they were just filthy-looking jumbo bags with recyclable waste wheeling along the streets. But thanks to graffiti artists who are giving them a makeover with bold and bright designs to help identify and protect the recyclers, artists say their goal is to build a relationship between neighborhood residents and waste pickers. The reclaimers roam around the city day and night, with some motorists even considering them a risk, as the trolleys are not always visible. There are some 6,000 reclaimers in Johannesburg who make a living collecting, sorting, recycling garbage. It's a messy job, but they do it anyway. A group of women are joining hands to protect one of India's key natural sites that is also on UNESCO's heritage list, the Western Ghats, a mountain chain that's facing severe deforestation. The 27 members of this all-female task force are doing all they can to protect the area's rare ferns, mosses, and thousands of other plants. They're using a variety of gardening tools and techniques to preserve species from all over the mountains. Not only that, but they also make artificial conditions and habitats for endangered species from other parts of the world, mainly those affected by climate change. One of the conservationists explained that what they are doing is actually helping the forest regenerate.
We have witnessed the birth of a forest, and that's a very powerful thing. You know, the mind is filled with the ghastly stories of forests being cut, like the Amazon or like the Western Ghats, but here we're witness to the birth of forests as well, and that is the forest itself birthing itself, you see.
The Western Ghats Mountains are home to nearly 5,000 species of flowering plants, but many of them are globally threatened. Only less than half of the area's flora is currently under conservation, scientists say. The outlook for the mountain is very concerning. Carbon dioxide is one of the causes of global warming, but can we get rid of it to save our planet? A Swiss firm has come up with a novel idea to store CO2 underground and turn it into rocks. Company Climeworks has started operating the world's largest direct air carbon capture and storage plant called Okra in Iceland. Located in Hershey, Okra is entirely run on renewable energy. It soaks carbon dioxide directly from the air and buries it as rocks deep underground to be mineralized. Usually, a natural process takes hundreds of thousands of years to turn the gas into basaltic rocks, but here it takes up to 2 years for the CO2 to turn into white crystals.
Once the carbon dioxide is captured, it will be dissolved in water, and here we are at the injection site. The carbon dioxide dissolved in water will come through this pipe into the well, where it will be injected into the volcanic rock at a depth of between 800 meters and 2 kilometers.
The plant is set to be removing 4,000 tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere each year. The amount is too little to save the planet from carbon emissions, as climate modeling suggests the world needs to eliminate several billion tons per year by 2050. Here we have to take into account the saying of the head of ARCA that we have to learn to walk before we can run.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Legends never die. So 1 year after his death, Argentinians are remembering their hero on his birthday. And that's no one but their legendary football player, Diego Maradona. It would have been Maradona's 61st birthday this year. People all around the country, including in the capital, Buenos Aires, remembered their iconic figure in ceremonies over the weekend. In the city of Rosario, a giant monument was inaugurated in honor of the football star. You can see on your screens fans gathering there in celebration. They say Maradona's love still runs in the veins of Argentinians. Amsterdam, the capital of the Netherlands, is riddled with waterways through which thousands of boats pass each day. Soon, the city may also be hosting self-driving vessels. Amsterdam's Institute for Advanced Metropolitan Solutions has devised an autonomous boat that can cross the city's busy canals without the help of a conductor. The watercraft, named a rowboat, is the size of a small car. The developers intend to use the boats for tasks ranging from transporting people to collecting trash. They think it can also be used for less conventional purposes, like preventing oil spills or forming a temporary bridge. Amsterdam's authorities are considering locations for a trash collection pilot project starting early next year. Disastrous effects of climate change has been the loss of glaciers worldwide. People around the world are trying new ways to tackle this problem. Now, a team of Chilean conservationists have come up with a creative project to protect glaciers and prevent water loss. The project is called Nilus. Winter rains are collected in cone-like structures called stupas. Experts from Chile are using a technology that was first developed in India to make these man-made glaciers. The water is then later used in the dry summer months. Chile has been experiencing a severe drought for years. Nilus director Enrique Gilona says the project hopes to address water shortages in the country.
Here we are not creating new water. Water is something that is in nature already. It has a cycle, but clearly it has been affected by the effects of the great climate change which we are facing, and we are looking for a solution that actually allows us to protect this water for a longer time in the mountain range, to be able to deliver it downstream toward the communities.
The goal is to store some 100 million liters of water across 50 stupas next year. This would be enough water to supply 100,000 people for 3 months. The first prototype was erected in park arenas, an area known for its glaciers surrounding a volcano, the highest parts of the mountain region. Researchers and activists have warned that glaciers in the Andes Mountains have been receding in recent years. They blame climate change for the loss of glaciers and water shortages. A photo on social media, an article, or a TV program can all draw attention to climate change. But to a German artist, nothing seems to be as effective as a journey using a giant wire ball to make his work. had. Arne Drosel started his journey from his hometown Paderborn, West Germany, 3 months ago. The trip has so far taken him through more than 60 cities. He has completed a journey to the Scottish city of Glasgow, the venue of a major UN climate conference. Drosel says he aims to tell people how they can help tackle climate change, now a key global problem. The German artist believes everyone has a duty to solve the problem to help next generations have a good future.
My wife and we have 5 children, and we want to give them a good and happy future. And everybody knows, I think, about the problems our Earth has, and we will have the same problem in several cities and countries.
The German artist says he has encouraged people to make specific promises to tackle climate change. He says his own pledge was to offset all his personal carbon emissions by using the sphere for his journey. Drosel says he will continue his efforts until the promises reach a million. Mission is to raise awareness of climate change in a 500-kilometer pilgrimage to Glasgow. The 3-meter polar bear is work of British furniture maker Bamber Hoss. The bear weighs 17 kilograms and is made of bamboo, willow, and tissue paper. Hoss started his journey with Clarion from his hometown of Bishop's Castle in England to Glasgow. They accomplished their spectacular journey ahead of the United Nations COP26 climate conference in the Scottish city. Hoss says Clarion is a symbol of melting Arctic ice caps due to global warming.
He's called Clarion. Clarion the bear is not a bear. He is a metaphor. He's a symbol. It is a very obvious symbol that a polar bear represents the Arctic, not the Antarctic, and that is where some of the problems are with melting ice caps, not all the problems because they're elsewhere as well.
Hoss says his aim is to encourage people to pay attention to climate change. Environmental activists from across the UK and elsewhere on the continent have also embarked on a long journey on foot to reach the UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow.